Morgan versus State. Again, this is Morgan versus State. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Dave Lopez, Assistant Attorney General, representing appellants Britton and McKinney. Your Honors, as a threshold matter, the district court failed to conduct a reasoned, thorough, and individualized analysis of these individual capacity, personal capacity appellants on their assertions of qualified immunity against the federal civil rights claims on the motion to dismiss the complaint.
Does that mean we can't get to them?
No, not at all. In fact, I would encourage the court to do both. I think that the optimal outcome here would be an order that does two things. One, makes clear to district courts in this state that they need to take seriously qualified immunity assertions when they're made. The federal courts, particularly the Eighth Circuit, have repeatedly established in myriad case law, most recently being Saylor, Payne versus Britton versus Payne from the Eighth Circuit, that simply refusing to issue an individualized thorough analysis of qualified immunity isn't enough. You have to conduct it. We don't make them casually, the district courts need to take them seriously. I think you could do what the Eighth Circuit did in Saylor versus Cole and recognize that while there was a failure to issue a thorough, reasoned, and individualized determination of the appellant's individual entitlement to qualified immunity, that there was nevertheless a denial and proceed to a de novo determination, this court could proceed to a de novo determination of the constitutional merits of those qualified immunity assertions. And I can shift to the merits of those unless you want to continue.
I would like to do that, but with after addressing one small thing.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the case that came up in the Supreme Court, the Nebraska Supreme Court, maybe a couple weeks ago, a few weeks ago, Heckman versus Markfield, that dealt with final orders?
I remember reading it.
Okay, and then basically they said unless there's statutory authority, we don't have appellate jurisdiction. Do you read that? Did you read that case to abrogate collateral order?
No. I don't. And I'm certainly happy to expand on that, Judge Bishop. Suffice it to say, I would stand on the jurisdictional arguments we made in our brief. I think this quite clearly falls under the collateral order doctrine. If you want additional specific authority from the U.S. Supreme Court on the viability of making a qualified immunity assertion at the motion to dismiss level, I think that's all.
And the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken specifically on qualified immunity falling into the collateral order doctrine. So
yes, and the Eighth Circuit has as well in a variety of different.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't have any problem
with the
heckling.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Pivoting to the merits of the constitutional claims here, I don't think it is a tough call that the amended complaint simply fails to allege federal constitutional claims against these two individual capacity defendants under either the First, Fifth, Eighth, or 14th Amendments. As a general matter, I think there's a serious personal involvement and a failure to plead any personal involvement by either former board McKinney or investigator Britton. And I know that can be a little cliche coming from a defense attorney claiming that something hasn't been sufficiently pled. But in the federal civil rights context, I think it's important when the deficiencies here are pretty glaring, especially when you consider that Warden Kenny was added as an amendment on the amended complaint, and Mr. Morgan opted to specify his involvement only in paragraph 31, saying that he had knowledge that he'd been told, do not talk about the rape to anyone.
Are there places, though, where he generally played defendants?
Sure, I don't think that's on. No, it's not. And here's why, Judge Gishel. I think it could be a slightly different analysis if it was the original complaint. This was the amendment. And so Mr. Morgan had the opportunity to think about where he wanted to include former Warden Kenny. And I think this court should honor his specificity. There's a lot of different allegations about who did what and when.
Wouldn't you agree Britton has a little more trouble in that regard? I mean, there are some pretty specific allegations.
A little more. And I acknowledge in my brief that it's a marginally more specific case against investigator Britton. Here's the problem with Britton. Britton was the investigator. He can't even be imputed to have had the reclassification authority at the prison, whereas Kenny certainly could have. Okay? But against Kenny, simply saying that he had knowledge that somebody had told Mr. Morgan not to speak about the rape, that on its face doesn't equal a federal constitutional violation.
But the fact that we're even talking on this retaliation First Amendment claim, the fact that we're even talking about the facts in this way, wouldn't that suggest that that would be a matter that would face in the district court and the proceed court? Not to say that it necessarily means that affirmative defense of qualified immunity, but there are still some facts at issue that are not just in play in that regard. I know you disagree.
Yeah, respectfully, Judge Lippert, I do disagree. I don't think. Look, when you think about the specificity for Britain, it says the complaint says that he interrogated him. Says that he advised him that there could be punishment for lying about him.
Go to jail.
That he could go to jail. There could be. I suppose there's a number of additional consequences that the system could impose on an inmate lying about having sexual assault at corrections. I don't know, it's a foreign concept to me, how that equals on its face a federal constitutional violation.
Do you think Morgan had to plead who was responsible for making the decision he could not be spoken to or speak to anybody at all except for Britain during the investigation?
For purposes of federal civil rights liability, yes. The Potter case from the Nebraska Supreme Court that you relied on in the first in Morgan 1 establishes that, and there's federal cases as well. A recent one, or one that was not specified in our brief, but I think dovetails with the same principles, Clemens versus Armentrout from the Eighth Circuit in 2007, 477 F3rd 962. It doesn't add anything new beyond what's pretty clearly laid out in Potter. But yes, I do think for purposes of assigning personal federal civil rights liability, that specificity is required. I'd add another note on that. You know, and I try to be very careful, given the procedural posture we're in, to confine our legal arguments on qualified immunity entitlement to the four corners of the complaint, as we have to, and presume that you would presume that everything he's alleged is basically as bad as it can be and true.
Because we're limited because it was it has to be a legal issue only. If there are any cracks in the statute, then we can't decide.
Absolutely. And I don't think, as I indicated in the brief, we're happy for you to assume everything he's alleged is true. But he can't get the benefit of inferences if he's self-defeated in his own claim. He can't, and frankly, with limited timing, I think it's obvious that the retaliation claim is only one of the federal claims that even
it's clearly the stronger.
Embryonically
violent.
Sure. I would conclude before I reserve time with this. On the retaliation claim, obviously, he has to have given the court something to infer retaliatory intent. And the problem in this case is that he also alleged that the same people that he's now trying to impose personal federal civil rights laws investigated the NAPTA, arrested and fired Hansen, and convicted him for the crime. So I think it's self-defeating to say, and that's not a factual difference, that's based on what he's said directly in his complaint. It's internally inconsistent to say, well, they wanted to cover it up, and they had a retaliatory intent. But at the same time, they tested the NAPTA on him, didn't crush it, and convicted them accordingly.
But can't you have can't it be both? It doesn't have to be one or the other. I mean, you can retaliate and still go through with an investigation, but it's that 30-day period or so. Isn't that really what's at issue?
I understand the question, Judge Pearl. The problem is that we run up against the entire body of water beside our reason that a protective custody or segregation, whatever you want to call it, classification for that kind of time period, really doesn't have any associated constitutional protections.
But it's beyond that, it's the manner of the interrogation, the alleged inducement to change the story by talking about the impact upon the guard and his family. So it's beyond just the isolation.
Jeff, I understand that he wants it to be, but I would be cautious with accepting those as sort of enhancers for purposes of stating a federal constitutional violation. That he's cited nothing to say that an interrogation wherein he is advised that he's lying about having been sexually assaulted by a prison guard, that that's grounds, or even gives them a little more of a foothold for a federal constitutional violation. I'd like to reserve the last 20 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Julie Jorgensen, and I'm appearing on behalf of the ABC. The amount of complaints in this case, although it is sort of brushed aside by the state, alleges that the appellee was raped by a prison guard, filed a grievance. In response to the grievance, he was placed in segregation. He was isolated from all other inmates. He was essentially isolated from all personnel, in that guards were instructed not to speak to him or acknowledge him. His rights with regard to telephone privileges were restrained, and he was ordered not to speak of the rape to his friends and family to the extent he was allowed in contact with. He was also, as is contained in the complaint, asked for counseling post-rape and was provided none while he was at the facility in question. He was repeatedly interrogated while he was isolated, and told that he could get more jail time, he could be prosecuted for perjury, if you're lying, you're going to jail. Those are clearly threats that are in retaliation for filing a grievance against a guard who raped him.
So let's talk about your other constitutional claims.
Okay.
Tell us in what way the allegations would support the claim of a violation of equal protection and due process or criminal interest.
First, with regards to the Eighth Amendment, there is law out there that discusses that the totality of confinement can rise to the level of Eighth Amendment violation. The state has consistently referred this as an administration decision, classification decision, but really it's more than that. The totality of the circumstances, this wasn't just, oh, you have a grievance against the guard, we're picking the segregation. There were, as the state stated, enhancements to the segregation, and those qualities of conditions makes it a violation also of the 8th and 14th Amendments.
So you're saying that it's cruel and unusual punishment that he didn't speak to the people he wanted to speak to? Isn't that more under your First Amendment? And it is cruel and unusual punishment.
Basically, it goes to several Supreme Court cases which talk about the totality of conditions in the prison. And you have to take the totality of conditions of what was going on with this prisoner at the time. So you have a person who's just been raped. You have a rape victim that is isolated. And not just he couldn't talk to people he wanted to talk to. He was isolated from everyone. Cut off from everyone, and then subjected to repeated interrogations. That goes beyond a mere condition of confinement. It is more atypical. It is an atypical hardship that you would not necessarily expect just because you are in prison. And that totality of the conditions is what differentiates this case from merely just being placed in segregation.
Sure. What allegation is there that he was treated differently than?
Well, basically, with regard to the due process equal protection argument, what our argument is in this case is a little bit different than the I was treated differently based on my gender.
Right.
It's not a protected class argument. It is that equal protection can also be established by showing an improperly motivated desire to prevent the exercise of constitutional rights. Basically, what we have in this case, you know, retaliation is probably the most straightforward here. He filed a grievance and all these things happened to him. But based on the totality of case law out there that talks about atypical hardships and an improperly motivated desire to prevent the exercise of constitutional rights, these constitutional violations sort of weave together based on the totality of his conditions. And it goes beyond just the idea that he was not allowed to talk to somebody. He was really isolated, intimidated, and interrogated in a way that was damaging to his mental health. And also, clearly, to prevent the exercise of his constitutional right, I recognize that the state argues that this is not the case, but I can't think of any other reason other than to get him to recant and to force him to give up his grievance would these activities have occurred.
Well, and unfortunately, because there's no moral record here, there may have been legitimate reasons for him to isolate for his own protection, for example.
Well, and to that point, there are several court cases that simply say motions to dismiss are not the best place for qualified immunity. Because simply the record isn't developed, there's been no discovery done, there are no depositions for you to look at. So it makes it very difficult to really flesh out the full idea of the case.
But so we're forced to focus on your client's allegations.
Sure.
I'm struggling a little bit with some of the due process and protection. So I'm asking for help here in terms of what he's alleged that really qualifies. Because that's the first step, right, as we're evaluating this under the collateral order doctrine, that we look and see, is there a constitutional claim alleged or violation of a constitutional case?
That's clearly established, yeah. And I'm more interested in that, too.
Yeah. I think we're not talking about, I think that, as I understand the court, you're comfortable with First Amendment argument that those have been clearly established as terms of
retaliation. We're not saying that, we're saying it's definitely stronger there.
Yes, okay, I'll start with the First Amendment.
No, there, we don't want you to.
Oh, you want me on the 14th? Okay. On the 14th only, I recognize that in this particular case, because it is not a based on gender, based on race type of equal protection argument, it is more difficult. But it is based on the idea that equal protection, it's an individualized case where equal protection is a violation is established by showing that they singled him out and there was improper motivation to prevent the exercise of his constitutional right. I understand that.
Are you making a separate due process claim as well?
There is a separate due process claim.
Can you address that?
Again, the due process and equal protection are very very similar, but with regard to his placement in segregation, it went beyond segregation. It wasn't a classification decision. Why it doesn't fall under the administrative discretion of classification in this case is it went beyond merely classification and segregation.
How do you respond to the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed that adverse conditions of confinement do not rise to a liberty interest?
Well, there are cases that do discuss the adverse conditions of confinement. But they do say, again, that the combination of conditions can be create an atypical hardship. And that is really where we're coming from on the equal protection and due process violation. This was an atypical hardship, given the overall circumstances where a rape victim is treated in the manner that he is. He is not offered any counseling services. He is isolated from everyone. He has no one to speak to except for an interrogator who continually threatens him. And that is our position, is an atypical hardship. That is not anything that would be under the guidelines of a prison regulation or prison classification system.
Can you speak to Mr. Lopez's remarks regarding insufficient personal allegations against either of these two defendants?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to Britton, Britton, it's clearly pled that he was the person making the threats, doing the interrogation, making the threats to jail.
What about Kenny?
With Kenny, we do plead that, and I apologize for not bringing the point up with me. We do plead that it was the actions of isolating Morgan and instructing no one to speak to Morgan was with the knowledge or at the direction of Kenny. And as you pointed out, in other places, we refer to defendants as a whole as far as more of a scheme or a plan. Thank you.
I do have one question for you. So is it your position that we can decide all of these issues based on this record, or is it better off to go back to the normal for another itemized decision by the lower court?
It is our position that it should just simply be remanded and allowed to go forward, discovery, proceed, etc. As this case has been pending for over 4 years, and we've been up twice on motions to dismiss, so a record has never really been established. And once a record's established, and if summary, and I'm sure a summary judgment will come on qualified immunity, I think all the courts would be better able to analyze it and make a decision on that basis. Thank you very much.
How much did we take, Mr. Robinson?
57 seconds.
You have that?
Yes.
So how much time is that?
It gives him a minute and 15 seconds.
May I please, Court, I'll focus exclusively on retaliation, Michelle, unless the court wants to draw me somewhere else. And on that issue, even if somewhere in the complaint there is something that resembles a retaliation claim, and I do not think there is, but even if there is, you have to look at paragraphs 31 and 34.
Because we're talking about the amendment, not the amendment, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. So this is T39 and 40 of the transcript, paragraphs 31 and 34 of the amendment complaint. That's a terminal extent of the specificity that's provided for either Investigator Britton or Mr. Kenny. So Mr. Warden Kenny, it's only part of paragraph 31. And that's just that he had
the direction and the knowledge of.
During that time, he was completely isolated. The plaintiff was instructed to speak to no one about the rape by the representatives of the defendants, including Brown and Britton, upon information and belief such instructions were at the direction or with the knowledge of him. It's not enough to equal a federal civil rights claim against Investigator Kenny. Then, Gordon Kenny, or Investigator Britton. Again, there's been no pleading that he wasn't an officer of the facility. There wasn't even any pleading that he had the authority to conduct this reclassification, just finishing the thought, into segregation. I would leave you with one additional thought, that for all of this talk of the segregation and interrogation having been atypical, equate that to the issues in Santiago and in Sandin versus Connor, and Wilkinson versus Austin. The plaintiff is simply restating the ordinary hallmarks of segregation, protected customs, limited privileges, things like that. The Supreme Court has said they do not equal constitutional violations. So in that context, we would ask you to reverse the denial of qualified immunity, and we would hope that you could also include a reminder to the district court the need for thorough determination of qualified immunity assertions.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. Matter is submitted.